keeping you entertained and informed.
Joel Rheinberger
on ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania.
Good morning to you. Australian colonial history is absolutely marinated in rum. The sailors who brought the early settlers here got a daily ration on board their ship. It was traded like money. I mean, I reckon maybe it had such value because being drunk was preferable to being sober in a prison camp on the wrong side of the earth. The military force provided by the British, which was properly called the New South Wales Corps, was better known as the Rum Corps because they got so much money and power from controlling its trade. Historian and author Matt Murphy has just finished a book about it, Rum, A Distilled History of Colonial Australia. Matt, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. When we talk about this early rum from colonial times, I'm sure it wasn't the sparkling spice delight we get for $100 a bottle these days. What was colonial rum actually like?
Well, all we know is that the words like putrid were often used to describe it. Apparently the good stuff came from West Indies, but that was a bit of a trip. Most of the early rum came from India, which was apparently not great. But also a lot of rum came from Brazil, which was apparently, well, most people considered it undrinkable, but, you know, if they had to drink it, they had to drink it. Yeah. And of course, we made our own, we started making our own, you know, backyard stills, started making all sorts of stuff that, I mean, apart from tasting bad, people just would have a sip and drop dead.
And it was really strong too, wasn't it?
Well, again, we don't really know, but we do know that the stronger the better. The sailors, especially, you know, before 1788, the sailors used to complain if when they added a bit of gunpowder to it and trained a magnifying glass on it, if it didn't explode. So to catch fire, it's got to be overproof, but they actually wanted to explode, which means it's got to be over 85% alcohol.
Wow, 85%.
Yeah.
And what was the sailor's ration of rum?
Well, that's the most amazing part of the book. Sometimes I think the most amazing part of the book is the first few chapters where it talks about these sailors and how much they drank. And we're talking at a max about 16 nips of rum a day, every day, which, you know, as I said, think of 16 rum and Cokes, take the Coke out and the ice. I mean, you and I don't know you that well, but I'm sure you couldn't have 16 rums a day, and you certainly wouldn't do it every day. But that was just the ration. If they crossed the equator, if they spliced the main brace, if it was the king's birthday, if it was the captain's birthday, it was just another excuse to add more rum to the
16 and 16 rums at 85 proof as well.
Well, again, maybe it wasn't 85 proof, you know, all the time, but yeah, that made them happy when it was, yeah.
And so,
I can add though as well that it was in 1823 they decided that maybe sailors under the age of 14 shouldn't have their 16 nips a day.
So, wow. And I bet they were upset, those sailors under 14. If you're a 13-year-old and you're used to drinking 16 tots of rum a day, you'd be pretty upset if it was taken away.
Well, some sailors, I mean, Admiral Bligh, you know, William Bligh, he joined the Navy when he was 7. So, I mean, I can't imagine 7-year-olds being given 16 nips of rum a day.
Wow. Now, we were drunk from day one of settlement on rum too, weren't we? Like, literally the first day that people landed, you know, Europeans landed to settle Australia,
yep.
There was a drunken party.
There was a drunken party. There was, I mean, some people call it an orgy. Some people call it a series of rapes. It was, yeah, a pretty nasty day, yeah. I mean, we celebrate Australia Day as being January 26th, but not all the convicts were off the boats until February the 6th. And there was a huge thunderstorm. Everyone ducked for cover, and it was mayhem, apparently, yeah. And they lost some sheep because lightning hit a tree where all the sheep were sheltered under, so a lot of sheep died. We went into starvation mode pretty early.
Imagine being stuck on a boat and watching everyone else get off. How horrible would that be? You've been on a boat for... How long did it take them to get here from England?
Oh, the first fleet... Jordan, I can't remember now. About four months, I think. I think it took four or five months.
Four months on a ship, and then you're watching everyone else get off and cavort around on land and drink rum, and you're stuck on board.
The second fleet, one of the ships in the second fleet, took 366 days, 1 year and 1 day. Yeah.
Now, how did rum end up becoming essentially money in the colony?
That's a great question, and a lot of pedantic historians say, look, it's not money, it's barter. You know, I give you, you know, some wheat and you thatch my roof. That's barter, right? And of course, rum is consumable. You can drink it. And of course, like, you might thatch my roof and I might give you some rum in payment and you'll drink it. So that is barter. But rum became more than that, in that you traded it. You traded it. You didn't drink it all the time. You traded it. And one of the best examples of that is John MacArthur. He was teetotal. He didn't drink rum at all, but he was the kingpin of the rum industry. So I think it's testament to how rum was a currency that the main guy who traded in it didn't drink it at all. Also worth reporting was George Johnson, who was the head of the Rum Corps. He actually got in trouble and got sent back to England and charged with using rum as payment to his officers.
Did he actually get successfully charged?
No, he didn't. No. Well, that was one of the... There's a lot of instances in the book. I'm quite surprised. Well, I suppose, I don't know if surprised is the word, but so many times people were sent back to England for offences, but England would just say, why are you sending him here for? All the evidence is back there. Or why are you sending him here for such a trivial matter?
Mm.
And so many times in the book I found that people were sent to England... hello, goodbye, and came straight back again. Yeah, John MacArthur included.
The punishment is 8 months on a boat, I reckon.
Well, the punishment's 8 months on a boat, but, I mean, John MacArthur, for instance, he had a duel with his superior, Lieutenant Governor Patterson, and shot him in the shoulder, so he was sent back for that. But nothing could be... I mean, John MacArthur was, as we know now, was a big-time sheep wool producer, but he really wasn't at the time. He happened to be in London when Marsden's sheep, a bale of Marsden's wool, arrived in London. And it was apparently the finest wool London had ever seen. And of course, MacArthur put his hand up and says, oh, yeah, I do stuff like that too. And so he was in the right place at the right time because of shooting his senior officer in the shoulder.
You're listening to ABC Radio Hobart and ABC Northern Tasmania. With us is Matt Murphy, author of this fascinating new book, Rum, A Distilled History of Colonial Australia. Look, Wally has just called us, Matt, and says he was in the Royal Navy from 64 until 70, and they still had a daily allocation of rum, half a gill of rum and half a gill of water per day.
That's it. As I understand it, in the British Navy, they stopped giving rum rations out in 1970, but in some navies, including apparently the New Zealand Navy, it kept going until into the 80s. But yeah, that 16 nets of rum a day, that was cut back to eight and then to four. And then they said, we'll cut it back again if we give you more meat and flour, those kind of things. And eventually in 1970, the general public just said, look, this rum ration is pointless, it's stupid. And, the drink driving laws and the breathalyzer and all kind of stuff, that's what got rid of it.
Well, it still turns up on Anzac Day, I find. You go to the Navy Club here in Hobart, and certainly they're drinking rum and milk. With
rum
their
and
breakfast.
Milk.
Yeah. I don't know why that's the particular thing, but they're all drinking rum and milk. Now, you've mentioned the Rum Corps.
Yep.
And they were the soldiers sent here by the British to kind of, be our armed forces and kind of the police. How did they end up earning the name Rum Corps rather than the New South Wales Corps, which is what they were properly called?
Well, going back a little bit further, I mean, you and I understand, every Aussie who's done a bit of history at school knows about the convicts who stole a loaf of bread and they got out here, or, stole a bit of lace or a bit of firewood. And that's sort of true, sort of not true. I mean, a lot of convicts did get sent out for pretty petty crimes.
Mm.
But the soldiers, the army, the police, as you call them, that were supervising them, they were far, far, far worse. I mean, they couldn't recruit officers to come out here. Who in their right mind would want to come all the way to the other side of the world to a penal colony? And so they end up recruiting from the military prison. Some of these Rum Corps guys, they were on life sentences. Some of them were facing death sentences, but were given a reprieve if they'll go to New South Wales. And so you end up with a vagabond rat bag bunch that was in charge of running the place. And the problem was that when Governor Phillip left in 1792, there was 3 years without any governor, no management. And so that's when the Rum Corps really came to the fore and just took over the place. And with a population that was completely adult, completely addicted, completely alcoholic, they just could do whatever they wanted to. They could sell things, they could buy things, knowing that, people are so desperate, they'll do what they can to get their hands on rum.
So the rum, as you said, was coming in from other places, from yep. India and Brazil and places like that.
Yep.
What were the early settlers distilling when they wanted to start making their own?
Everything. They distilled their own crops, their own apples, peaches, stuff like that. Backyard brewing became a big thing. When the Irish arrived here, after the Irish rebellions, a lot of Irish arrived here in the late 1700s, and that's when it really hit the fan, if you know what I mean, because they not only brought their Irish rebellious spirit with them, they also brought the knowledge of how to make backyard brews. So they brewed all sorts of stuff. We have no idea how much, we have no idea how potent it is, other than a few people died just from having a sip or went blind. But the Rum Corps were told to destroy all these stills. And initially, as they did start destroying all these stills, then realised it's a much better idea to actually encourage these stills and just take their cut of the profits instead. So there was a lot of backyard distilling going on, with the Rum Corps just turning a blind eye in, you know, for a backhander.
Now, we are in Tasmania, Matt. How much yes. did rum penetrate to Tasmania? What stories do you have to tell us about our own history here?
Well, you guys, I mean, I know only because I've been to Tasmania. I love Hobart, but I remember I had to look at Google Maps before this interview, and your main street is Davey Street, right in the middle of Hobart.
Yeah,
is that right?
Runs past the back of this very building.
Yeah, and Thomas Davey, what a guy. I mean, you guys really got the cream of the crop when it comes to drunks as for a leader. Thomas Davey was a legend. He was a lieutenant governor, which means although he was in charge of Van Diemen's Land, he was second in charge under Macquarie, who ran the place from Sydney. When he arrived, his first port of call was Sydney to learn the ropes from Macquarie, and Macquarie just instantly didn't trust him, didn't like him, and refused to let him do anything. He said, "You're not allowed to write any promissory notes. You're not allowed to pay for anything." He just told Davey, "We don't trust you." When Davey arrived in Hobart, he stopped off the ship and went straight into a bar and ordered a cocktail, which he invented called Blow Your Skull Off, which at the time was one third rum, one third brandy, and one third beer.
there's only one reason to drink that, isn't there? Wow. And its flavour is certainly not part of it.
Well, it's called Blow Your Skull Off for a reason, I'm sure. But it's worth adding that I don't know about Hobart's cocktail bars, but if you go to some swanky cocktail bars, you can still order it. If you Google it, you can still find Blow Your Skull Off, or just called Blow Your Skull. And it's now not rum, brandy, and beer. It's got all fancy stuff in it. But during the gold rushes in Bendigo, Ballarat, they drank it with opium in it.
Wow, that is really unbelievable.
More bang for your buck, yeah.
Certainly.
But you guys really got a beauty. You know, Thomas Davey, he's fantastic. Yeah, you guys really got a great leader down there. Yeah, you win.
Matt Murphy, great speaking with you. Thank you so much for being with us this morning.
Pleasure, mate. Thank you very much.